This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 855 AM, Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. In particular, we acknowledge the Wangan and Jagalingu cultural custodians and their ongoing opposition to coal mining on their lands in central Queensland, and to the Gomeroi traditional custodians' continuing opposition to coal and gas on their land in New South Wales. It is vital at this late stage in history that we all learn to care for country. It will always be Aboriginal land, and now is our time to all stand up for and protect it.
Today's focus is on the tropical forested countries, which will benefit from the big initiative launched at COP30 in Belém. It's called the TFFF, or Tropical Forests Forever Facility. It's a financial facility worth billions. Think of countries like Brazil, Colombia, Costa Rica, West Papua, PNG, Malaysia, Indonesia, Ghana, and the countries of the Congo Basin. Think of them being reframed as providers of ecosystem services, not logs, not minerals, intact forests. If the rich world invests in this fund, it would be investing in the lungs of the world. Carbon drawdown, forest respiration through the biotic pump, which we'll learn a lot about today, are the essential services to be invested in. Norway has committed $3 billion already. To qualify, participating countries must prove they have maintained a certain amount of forest canopy. Already in Brazil, since Bolsonaro was put in jail, and Environment Minister Marina Silva has tightened up the laws, the deforestation in Brazil has decreased by 30%. They monitor it by satellite. We'll hear from Brazilian journalist Claudia Antunes, climate diplomat and architect of the Paris Agreement, Cristiana Figueres, and also from former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Later in the show, we'll hear how that biotic pump of the forest really works in an interview with Jane Morton, sent to me by my colleague Antimony Dior. But to ease us into the reality of the Amazon, here is the voice of Yanomami women, read by Lisa Clegg, from the platform for journalists in the Amazon called Suma Uma. Suma Uma is a platform for Amazon journalists, and today we'll hear from a group of Yanomami women navigating against the end of the world. They are sailing down to Belém, where the global climate conference COP30 is making great strides to protect the Amazon forest. It's important for all of us because the Amazon forest is the lungs of the world. But for these women, it's far more personal. Lisa Clegg is with us to read the manifesto from the Yanomami women about giving birth in the Amazon. Lisa, tell us a bit about Indigenous women in Australia giving birth.
So for centuries, we've been able to give birth, but it's all changed now because of colonisation. And the change in the environment where we live is very, you know, mining industries and other industries have come into play that are destroying our countries. And so we have to take that into consideration about what we do in regards to birthing on country. And also there's a lot of politics around birthing on country when we're talking about the medical model of how people perceive birthing now. But it is a very natural, beautiful moment of women coming together to go through a process of birthing.
Yeah. Well,
And
would
now
you?
that's not what's happening. Yeah.
No. Well, that's what the Yanomami women are trying to protect for themselves. Their right on their Yanomami territories are still very forested and very north of the Amazon River. And hopefully, they're hoping that this climate conference will protect that part of their forest and their livelihood and their possibility of birthing as they always have. So, would you like to read their manifesto for us, please?
Yes. So good afternoon. I'm going to translate for you Awana, which isn't just a language translation, but it is also a translation of the world, said Anna. And she translates, "We, the Yanomami women, give birth to our children on the forest floor. We, the ones who go give birth to children there without the help of men. Men cannot be with us. And why do we do this? Because the forest is clean. Because where I live, there is no disease. The ground is clean. We give birth to our children on the forest floor because there is no disease there. And afterwards, we hold our children in our arms, wash them, and take them near to the fire. That is why the way we women live in the forest, on the forest floor, we take the care of the forest. We protect it. We protect the trees, the water, the animals, and also the spirit." Anna pauses to explain. Spirit is what the Yanomami call the auxiliary spirits that are throughout the forest and that assist the shamans in treating people, the sick, and healing the forest. And that also holds up the sky. And since we women are here on the forest floor, protecting and defending it, we don't want the Napi to approach our land. We live in the forest. For us, the forest is generous. Because it feeds our children, and you destroy the Napi. That's why we want the forest protected, so that we continue to have our children born on the forest floor. For all the children, we need to be born in the forest. For all the childhoods that need to happen in the forest, we are here. In the struggle, in the listening, navigating against the end of the world.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
Historic success story is the Rainforest Foundation, started by the musician Sting and his wife Trudy Styler in the 80s. Here they are talking with Kayapo chief Rayoni at a press conference in 1989 in Switzerland. This foundation is now funding projects in 20 countries, protecting 28 million acres of forest. And it is generally regarded as a very good model for this sort of forest protection, where you give the money to indigenous communities, local communities who can demarcate and protect their land from incursions, illegal logging and mining, for example.
My name is Sting. I'm here because I'm a friend to Rowney, because I'm worried about the world my children will inherit, and because I love Brazil. I'm very proud to be sitting with a man who, for me, is the symbol of a struggle, the struggle to save the rainforest. When I think of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, I think of Nelson Mandela. I think of Bishop Tutu. So for me, Rowney is the human face of this problem. He's been fighting this battle for 30 years. It's very encouraging to see so much media attention on this problem. If I was a poor Brazilian and I had no wages, no land, no way of feeding my children, then I too would burn the forest. And so would everyone in this room, because I would feel I had no choice. When you're desperate to eat, you'll do anything to survive.
Suma Uma has been a wonderful discovery for me. Its journalists from the heart of the Amazon say they are war correspondents from the war against nature. That's what it feels like for them. I love that. And their articles at Belém, every day there's new ones. You can look it up under Suma Uma.
Gunderman. This is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yawuru country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time. Where I belong.
You are listening to the Climate Action Show and we're at Belém in Amazonas today. Jacinda Ardern echoes the ideas of Chief Rayoni in this comment, courtesy of a podcast called Inside COP. She's talking to Cristiana Figueres, who is one of the architects of the Paris Climate Accord. They're talking about the urgency for Pacific people to make progress.
I think on the one hand, you're absolutely right, Cristiana. We've got to acknowledge the progress that's been made. And progress has been made.
And not sufficient at all.
But not sufficient.
Not at all.
And I think that's what the Pacific, you know, anyone at leader level who ever implies that kind of, well, you know, at least we've done this much, when your survival is dependent on it.
Totally.
Of course that's
makes no sense. No, I totally understand. So, Jacinda, there are two things that Brazil as a COP presidency has put front and center that are quite unique for a COP. One is the importance of forests, because we haven't seen that. And the other thing that they have put front and center, which is very, very intimately related with forests, is the leadership of indigenous peoples, of indigenous communities, of First Nations. It is so refreshing and so long coming.
Oh, I agree. You know, my hope is that for future COPs, we see an ongoing centrality for the indigenous voice in these discussions, because, you know, if we lived in a world in which the indigenous practices for our environment
were mainstream,
we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't need a COP. From New Zealand's perspective, of course, indigenous New Zealanders, Māori, have a principle which they very generously share with New Zealand as a whole. And the principle is that of kaitiakitanga, that we are the guardians of our environment, and that as guardians, our job is to hand over to the next generation an environment that's in better shape than we found it. And when you think of the notion of guardianship over and above notions of ownership, it does change your thinking. With my old hat on, I think what I was always mindful of is it's not enough to come out and amplify the overarching goals unless you're demonstrating you're walking the talk at home. You want to be able to lead, because then there is some economic advantage, you know, to being a first mover, to being the innovator, to creating the technology that others need.
Absolutely.
But we also do borrow from each other. So I think the leadership opportunity is not just to amplify the important messages. It's to walk the talk and start bringing to the table, you know, those ideas, initiatives and investments that are going to make a difference.
From Brazil, now we have esteemed journalist Claudia Antunes. You can read her articles in the Suma Uma website. It's in the heart of the Amazon. Today I've asked her to talk about the TFFF, which was launched last week at COP30 in Belém. It's a game-changing new way of preserving the tropical forests. Her article, which just got me interested, was the Tropical Forest Forever Facility, Banking on Capitalism to Save the Planet. I think that's the most comprehensive article I've read. So it was really a good introduction, Claudia. So welcome. Just first of all, tell us what it's like there at COP30.
Well, it's very hot and humid, like it is in Belen. So I think that everyone that's coming from outside, it's really a different experience from the one that people have had, at least in the last two COPs, né? In Dubai and Baku. Also because we are here in a democracy, so there is a great popular participation in the COP. Lots of social movements of the Amazon basin of Brazil have come to Belém. So we have a parallel People's COP. And, you know, so it's quite, besides the negotiations and the things that always go on, yeah, at COPs, This year we have this lots of parallel debates and lots of people from Brazil and from countries nearby, from the Amazon, Peru, Colombia, Ecuador, yeah, coming and willing to try to have a voice in the conversation. So I think we had during the organization of the COP these problems of logistics, because Belém is really not like Rio de Janeiro or São Paulo with lots of hotels and some and things like that. But I think that at the end, everything is being solved. So it's very good to be here and to have everyone from all over the world. Yes. Oh,
yeah. I think you've got a lot to be proud of. I'm already hearing some good things out of there and just achieving it, really, and achieving your democracy. That's something wonderful, really, in this modern day and age where really...
Yes, yes. It's also a COP of resistance, because we have all this denialism going on in the world. Yeah. And the fact that we have managed to have now we have a government with problems, of course, and contradictions in what relates to nature and climate. Yeah. But it's also it's not an extreme right government, and it's not denialist. And so I think this is great. And we have very experienced diplomats from Brazil. Yeah. At the leading the COP, so in spite of the very bad mood in the world in general, yeah, I hope or everyone is hoping that this COP can advance, yes, in good resolutions. Yes.
Yes, and it's so serious. I've been looking at the. And listeners, you must look up Suma Uma. It's a very interesting website, and some of the films that are available there, just showing the life of Indian people, indigenous people who thought their land was protected, but it's not really demarcated properly, and it's overlapping with other people who've come in. A lot of illegal clearing is still, yes, going on, and they really protecting. It's very serious. It's not something just fantastical. It's serious, and they... Get a voice in Suma Uma, and I'm so glad you're having that people parallel conference with the interest groups, non-governmental groups and local groups. That's so important that they get a voice and get ideas, yes, to each other.
And especially in the Amazon, we have a lot still of land problems. So yes. So we have lots of people trying to grab indigenous peoples and local communities' lands. So this is still really a problem in Brazil. Yes.
I know, but I think things are moving in the right way. And I've, yeah. Look, let's keep going. You've got a woman environment minister called Marina Silva. And I liked what she said. She said, for the first time, we have a global mechanism now that recognizes the value of forest ecosystems services and offers permanent incentives for their preservation. So that's this new TFFF, listeners. It's a facility to get funding to the tropical forest countries. What are those ecosystem services?
Well, they are many. They have to do not only with absorbing carbon because of the photosynthesis of the trees, but they also have to do with the regulation of the weather, because have you ever heard about the flying rivers from the Amazon?
Yes.
So the respiration of the forest, it produces vapor, this air that really is fundamental to the rain regime in most of South America. So until the middle of Brazil and the region. So so besides absorbing the carbon that the human activities, especially the burn of fossil fuels, sends to the air, I think the forest has this provides this service. But we also think at Sumauma that we should also look at the nature, forest as people and as nature, because not only in its, carbon related and weather related functions, but also it's a place of the biggest biodiversity in the world, the Amazon forest, and we have lots of peoples and communities that have been living here and resisting inside the forest for centuries, for millennia. In fact, it's interesting because we have had it's very difficult to do historical and archaeological research in the forest, but this is a field of study that has been developing very quickly in Brazil recently, and these archaeologists have proved that we have had people living in the forest and in fact planting the forest for more than 4,000 years. So it's interesting. The forest is also part of a human construct of these communities and civilizations that have been living here. It's not like the pyramids or other monumenta, but they can be traced, So I think it's interesting. Yeah. But in the case of the fund that you want to talk about, it's really a way this fund has been devised by the Brazilian government really as a way to compensate, to try, because, I think that in purely economic terms,
yes,
the big problem is how the standing forests can have more value than a destroyed forest.
Yes.
Because, because what people do, they destroy the forest to sell the land for agriculture, in general for agribusiness, for cattle ranching, and how we can give value to the forest in this economic system that we live in order to prevent its destruction. So the fund has been designed in this context to of the need to give value economic value to the standing forest, you know.
Yes. Well, I refer listeners to your article, which is very, very comprehensive, but could you put it just in a nutshell? How does this fund work?
Well, the idea of the fund is that it's like any financial, international financial fund. Yes. So, firstly, the idea is that, and this I think is the most difficult part. So, the idea is to raise $25 billion in investments from governments. And this money, this is not a donation. So this is really a market fund. Yeah. This is not a donation. The idea is that governments invest in the fund. They will receive an annual payment, from this money of the governments that's raised, the idea is that it's work as a guarantee to sell bonds in the market for banks, pension funds, so that you can get what they aim to is to get to $125 billion of money in order to pay $4 for each hectare. I don't know, of forest.
Yes, hectare. Yeah. Well, look, some countries have already invested. I think we shouldn't lose heart just yet. Brazil put in $1 billion to start the ball rolling. Indonesia $1 billion. Norway, $3 billion, and Portugal, $1 billion. And I did read today that Germany and France are negotiating, you know, they're discussing it right now. And from Australia, we had a foundation, listeners might be interested, called the Mindaroo Foundation. It's a foundation by one of our big mining magnates, Twiggy Forrest, and his wife. They've invested $10 million. But I think once it becomes more well known, and it'll start seeming like a good investment, except that, as you said in your article, we have to, at the moment, contend with the mood swings of Donald Trump and all of that, you know, all of those strange, yeah, big shifts. It's like we're in a schizophrenic world. So how solid do you think the forest facility will be in the context of capitalism? Because market capitalism is always chaotic.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they've been preparing the model for this fund for more than 2 years. So, of course, the great thing is, as any capitalist venture, it has some risk because you have these market swings like we had, for instance, 2008, like we had during the COVID outbreak pandemic. So, yes, the fund, as any market mechanism, will be subjected to these mood swings of the market. Yeah. They did some model, and so what they, for instance, I think they went 20 years back, and if we find a situation like the one in 2008, if a situation such as the one of 2008 is repeated, then this would be a year where the forest countries would receive no money.
Yeah.
You know, so there is this risk. The countries may receive the money and the money goes direct to the treasure so they can use it in permanent programs to conserve the forest. And the second thing is the novelty is that all the countries, forest countries that want that may participate, want to participate in the fund, they will have to make the compromise to that 20, at least 20% of the money raised is going directly to indigenous peoples and local communities that will create in each country like an agency.
Yes.
Well, to manage this money, to manage this money. So this is very new as well in terms of the power that you give to these communities that protect the forest, you know.
It's very well known that, you know, if you want to protect forests, Indigenous people are the ones to do it. And I think in another one of your articles about agriculture or agribusiness, you said deforestation is highest on private property, 58%, compared to 4%. In Indigenous territory. So Indigenous people keep that biodiversity. They don't go for monoculture. You know, they don't destroy, they preserve. And so how will the funds, do you think, be spent? What sort of projects? I think it could be a great innovation, like a lot of new ideas will come to play. But one thing you said, I think, in the article, they might want firefighting services. Well, that seems like a very worthwhile thing.
Yes, of course, especially with global warming. Exactly. Normally, yes, the tropical forests don't get fire if they are entire. But with the global warming, we have had lots of droughts and, you know, so the weather is changing. So the forest is becoming more inflammable. I think that also the indigenous communities and local peoples can invest in activities for their well-being. For instance, they can put a solar panel. We have indigenous communities in Brazil that are very distant from the others, so they can invest in communication. So they can invest this in their well-being. Also is important for the newer generation of indigenous peoples and we have lots of local communities besides indigenous peoples that live in the forest here. And there is this question of the new generations that generally they have, they study more than their parents. And if they cannot, they don't have a good perspective for living in the forest, they tend to go to the cities. So there are lots of people, things that indigenous peoples can do that will in the end keep them living in the forest and conserving it, you know.
That's right.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Look, I'm wondering if it would only work. We have to think of a lot of different countries, not just Brazil, but all that those countries where there are tropical forests. These are the lungs of the world. We have to put self-interest. You know, we have to realize this is climate changing to remove them, and it's climate preserving to keep them there. But would this only work really in a country where the rule of law is strong, where, you know, where you can pick up? I imagine, for example, you'd have to monitor the projects. What if a drone went over, you know, you're monitoring it with drones and you found up that areas had been logged illegally, you know, this illegal logging had happened. How would the fund work in countries like that where the law isn't very strong?
Yes, I think this is really a challenge, and I think that the fund will the idea of the fund that it will constitute a kind of council that will give help to countries that have less where the rule of law is not tight, or that have less technology to monitor the forests. To help them, I think they will have to be helped, and I also think that local communities in these countries will have to be mobilized to monitor the government actions. Another feature of the fund that each country with forests is obliged to establish a mechanism of grievance, an internal domestic mechanism. So if people have something to complain about how the government is managing the fund, they must have this channel to do it, you know. So there is some clauses that want to protect, but of course I think that is dealing with the fund will be much more challenging for some countries that where the rule of law is less So I think this is a question. I think there will be some help from the council, and also because the countries to receive the money, they won't be able to have a level of deforestation higher than 0.5% per year.
So they lose their funding
Their funding if it's higher than 0.5, and if it's less, any deforestation will lead to discounts in what a country receives. But if it's more than 0% of the area of the forest, then it will receive no money. Okay. It will have to. So this, lots of things will be a challenge in this, you know, Vivian. But I think that's really an idea that tries to complement other kinds of resources that these countries can access.
Yes, I agree. Just one other thing. Often with the climate action work I do, the problem is the mining companies. Australia exports a lot of coal and gas, you know, and it's these big companies that seem to even rig our parliament. You know, they seem to get in everywhere. And you've just had that thing with getting President Bolsonaro into prison. And I was very pleased to see he had about five or six other top cabinet people who had been helping him, you know, keep the forests being logged and keep the mining going on. They're all in prison now for 20 years and more. So I'm pleased to see that happening. But what about big lobby groups like agribusiness? I've been in Malaysia, for example, and you can see all these hills of red earth completely, raining down, just eroding, where they've just planted, destroyed a jungle and put down palm oil. And those big companies, how would you be making it worth their while to not plant palm oil, to leave the forest where it is? How would this fund, you know, appeal to those people or make it much more profitable for them not to do it?
Yeah, you know that this is one of the things that the government could use the fund, if the Brazilian government, in the case of Brazil, for instance, if the Brazilian government manages to get money from the fund, one of the things that the Brazilian government could do is pay the farmers to conserve the forest, because in Brazil we have a forest code. That, for instance, in the Amazon, even if you are a private owner of land, you can't log than 20% of your land. Yeah. So you have to keep 80% of the land, of the forest, standing.
Yes.
Of course, this not always work because you have, you know, lots of people go outside the law. There are lots of land problems in Brazil, or for instance, they for logging, they invade public land. But then you can use this also. But in the base, sometimes you have these farmers that they just destroy the forest because for them it's more profitable to raise cattle and sell it than to keep the forest standing. So perhaps they can keep more than the 80% that they have to keep in the Amazon, or 50% that they have to keep in other biomas, if they can get some paying, like a direct payment for it, you know.
Yes.
I'm just thinking, because of course, industrial agriculture is as as well as mining is also also huge problems in Brazil. And the industrial agriculture, like soy, they have lots of political power, including in Congress, you know. And this political power is financed by all the huge international trading companies of soy and the companies that sell fertilizers, companies that sell pesticides. So this is, we have a huge lobby of this big agriculture sector in Brazil, linked to the trade of agricultural commodities.
Yes.
That's really difficult to be contained, you know, because in a sense they are more powerful.
Well, I'm delighted to see this initiative. At least it sounds like something new. It's complex, but it's. I hope it will work. I'm also delighted to see President Petro in Colombia. He's, you know, leading by example, and next year he's having a conference exclusively on phasing out fossil fuels, not mixed with any other subject, just that one subject. And they've had biodiversity conferences in Colombia too. So I think there's a lot of bold initiatives coming out of South America, and I'm just so welcoming that. I hope really that the COP conference doesn't exhaust you and you keep doing marvelous reporting from it. And listeners, you should look up Suma Uma, read Claudia Antunes, her articles. But just Claudia, just to finish, tell us a little bit about Suma Uma and the kind of journalism you do there. I think it's very different from the mainstream big city journalists.
Yes, in fact, Suma Uma has been created by a very well-known journalist in Brazil. Her name is Eliane Brum. One of her books, Amazon, the Center of the World, this idea that here the Amazon is where life is. So Suma Uma has been created by Eliane, and we have a very good mix of journalists. We have some more journalists like me. I originally worked for commercial newspapers and so on. But we have also journalists that we call forest journalists, people from communities here in the Amazon. We have a good mix, and we try always to do things that no one else see, to really report on the region from the perspective of people that live in the region.
Oh, it's very valuable. So thank you. We've been talking to esteemed journalist Claudia Antunes in Brazil. She's given me her time running off to now to the day of COP conferences, I think. You can find her articles at Suma Uma. So thank you very much, Claudia, and good luck for the conference.
Thank you so much, Vivian. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank I'm really you. Glad that you have so much interest in the tropical forests and in what's happening in Brazil.
I went to Brazil myself 30, 40 years ago, and it changed my life seeing the Amazon, just going up there in a ferry up to Iquitos. I think we went the whole way.
Suma Uma journalist Claudia Antunes in Belém.
And even subtropical rainforests that don't usually burn were actually on fire.
We have the obligation to care for country.
So much forest burnt that around 3 billion animals are either killed or displaced.
The more we push back against the colonial apparatus, the more positive change we can have in terms of addressing climate change.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
So now we have a veteran climate campaigner, Jane Morton, with an additional reason why funding the Tropical Forest Forever facility is necessary. We could call the global climate. Jane's in conversation with Antimony Dior.
Dr. Anastasia Makareva is a Russian atmospheric physicist and senior researcher at the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute. She's best known for co-developing the biotic pump theory alongside Professor Viktor Gorshkov. The biotic pump theory suggests that intact, healthy forests play a crucial role in cloud formation, effectively influencing rainfall patterns over land. Her work emphasizes the importance of regenerating forests to maintain climate stability or even reverse some of the warming that we've seen. Her work challenges conventional climate models to incorporate the dynamic role of vegetation in atmospheric processes. And I talk with veteran climate campaigner Jane Morton about Anastasia's work and what she thinks the significance might be for the COP30 conference.
So for people who aren't familiar with her theories, can you start by explaining who Anastasia Makareva is, what her research has revealed about the important role of forests in the climate?
Anastasia is an eminent Russian physicist who worked under an even more eminent professor in developing the theory of the biotic pump, which is an explanation of forests as drawing the moisture in from the sea. Apparently it's still contentious, but I think you'd say growing in acceptance. It's part of a whole package of physics-based understandings that she's got, which include not only forests as drawing moisture in from the sea, but also forests as having an actual cooling effect that's beyond their carbon sequestration. Anastasia, one of the things that I think is really lovely and inspiring about her is that she comes from an actual love of the forest, which is really apparent, you know, when you actually watch her videos. It's really worth going and having a look at them. So her view is in some ways based on a sort of Gaia-type view of forests. That she says that they've evolved over millions of years, and it looks as though it's when broadleaf forests evolved that the moisture started to come in, the rainfall started to fall over the land. So the trees are actually what actually brought fertility and to the land.
Would you be able to give a short explanation of what this biotic pump is and how it works, like the mechanism of it?
Sure. All right, so Anastasia is identifying some processes that happen internally to forests. And one of the really important ones is that as the energy from the sun comes down, if it hits bare earth, the energy from the sun is turned straight away into sentient heat, heat we can feel. If the energy from the sun hits a forest, a whole lot of that energy goes straight away into evaporating the water that's coming out of the leaves of the forests. So this is actually, you know, one of the most energy intensive things we do in our house is boil a jug of water. It actually takes a lot of energy to turn water into vapour. So this is what the forest is doing. So a lot of the sun's energy is not going into heat. It's going straight into evaporation, evapotranspiration, right? So then having evaporated water vapour then rises along with little particles from the forest. And together they actually help form the clouds over the forest. Now the thing that happens as the cloud forms is that the water vapour is now condensed. Now at that point it actually is releasing latent heat, but by then it's very high in the atmosphere. And so some of that latent heat is then released out into space. This is one of the cooling mechanisms. But the other thing that happens is it creates a bit of a vacuum, and that's what she thinks sucks in the air from nearby, which if it's the sea and it's moist, is the way well, it's really the only way. Well, it's one of the ways that moisture from the sea gets on land.
Yeah. Now, she's got this beautiful analogy that she says. She says that the way that we study forests now isn't actually like a true reflection of their real capacity, because like the forests that we know now have been like subjected to like centuries of logging and disturbance. They're not the forests that they used to be. She says it's like just trying to study how the human body works by looking at like sick patients in the hospital, and that like healthy forests actually work quite differently.
Yes. She really stresses that it's intact forests that are the absolute gems, you know, the treasures that we must preserve at all costs, that have this special sort of millions of years of evolution working still. But yes, that particular comment comes from her talking about the climate models, which is very interesting. And her lead up to that comment is that climate scientists tend to model, you know, where they are, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are in Europe, where it's really hard to be a forest left, you know. So that's where she says, you know, they're based on very sick forests, or, you know, almost non-existent forests.
Mm-hmm. So on one hand, we've got, if the forests are degraded, then everything's going to shit quicker. But on the other hand, if we can restore the forests, then this can actually have a protective effect on the climate.
Exactly, yes. So, you know, I'm sad to not see this being talked about more as we lead into this Amazonian COP, because we are, it seems, everyone, you know, mainstream science recognises that we're at this crucial tipping point for the Amazon. That's just based on conventional understandings. So basically what it means is that if you add in the effects on rain and on direct cooling, we are completely, we've completely had it if we just destroyed these tropical forests. On the other hand, there is actually a recent book called Cooling the Climate by Rob DeLay and Peter Bunyard. Now, they've got some figures, and I'm not too sure about the figures, but they come up with the idea that we could cool the climate by 1 degree over just 20 years by restoring a fairly large amount of rainforest. Even if they're maybe overestimating the amount of cooling that you could do that way, it still does boil down to exactly what you said, that if we destroy these forests, that it could be a way lot worse than we even expect, really bad. But if we seriously put our backs into restoring them and other ecosystems as well, that we might get more effect than we've been expecting, because it is definitely not just carbon drawdown that these ecosystems do. It's definitely more than that. Exactly how much, as far as I can tell looking into it, it's very hard to exactly put a figure on it, because these processes are very complex. That's why they haven't been in the climate models properly, because they're just very hard to model, so it's very hard to give a proper estimate. But yes, it's something that actually gave me a lot of hope. Like, I've been a climate campaigner now for 15 years. In fact, I think it's nearly 18 now. Climate emergency campaigner, looking the scariest sort of stats in the eye, pushing for recognition that we've passed 1.5 for all practical purposes, pushing for David King, you know, Sir David King's 3 R's, that we have to do not just a reduction of emissions, but we have to draw down the excess that's already up there, and then we have to do climate repair.
Yeah, I think there's this idea that forests are just this passive thing. There's just trees, they just stand there. You can't really see them doing anything. Yes. But her idea is that, no, they're playing an active role, they're self-regulating, they want to be in a certain climate, and they do things to create that climate for themselves over time.
To create the climate for themselves. But I think it is, you know, even again in conventional science, recognised that the Amazon, for example, is creating, you know, living conditions for the trees and the ecosystem, but it's also providing the rain for much of the food-growing area in South America and in the United States, you know. So this effect on the rain is very important. There is a view amongst some Indigenous people and some people who are living in the northwest of Australia that there used to be what they call the pearl shell dreaming, the pearl shell songline that went down from Broome. That's why it's called pearl shell, right? And there's a trade route that was used by Aboriginal people that goes right down into the centre of Australia. And it was when the pearl shell wind used to bring rain down from Indonesia, and it would sweep in through Broome and actually provide more water, more rain than we have now in the centre of Australia. So, you know, the things that we can do actually in Australia to restore ecosystems, to restore particularly river catchments, so there's more water in the landscape and hence more vegetation, that might just bring, you know, some more rain into those areas that are getting very, very hot and dry. Because there's absolutely no doubt, and this is solid, that the vegetation, even a small amount of greening, does provide local cooling, right? It changes the amount of the sun's energy that goes into sentient heat, into heat that we can feel. So, you know, even having grass or shrubs and greening will cool things locally. But yes, if you know, say up in Queensland, we've got actually intact rainforests, you know, we have to treat them like these precious jewels, because there's no doubt that just planting pine trees or something or, you know, or even planting gum trees. It's just not the same. It hasn't got this Gaia-type wisdom.
Yeah, it has to be this integrated ecosystem, like a human body itself regulates. It needs to have all its different working components working together.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Mm. Yeah, given that politics, as we know, is so slow and, let's say, compromised, what can we do? What can people do now? What's the best thing for us to do?
In some ways, the fastest thing, I think, that is actually to literally ring your politician, you know, to put in a submission on the EPBC Act reforms. You know, it's good to do protests. It's good to, you know, go and stand outside your politician's office. It's good to try and meet with your politician. But the main thing, is to get the message through to them. We actually have a project going through Extinction Rebellion and with other groups called Tell the Truth. Mm-hmm. And we literally just go and meet with politicians, especially fresh new Labor ones we've just been meeting with. Mm-hmm. And we just try and convey to them how serious this is, and that in the end, what they will be remembered for is whether they acted on the climate emergency. You know, that whatever they can do on sort of education or health or something like that, it's gonna be destroyed if we go into climate collapse and societal collapse. So trying to get them to recognize that nothing is more important in their lives than what they do, because they're in the driver's seat for this incredibly crucial period. I think that process of sort of values-based change with any wealthy people that you know, any politicians that you know, that nothing is going to be more important, that the thing that they will be remembered for, if they have influence, is what they did about this.
Yeah, I tell you what, just with the Liberal National thing this week, everyone's talking about net zero 2050. I feel like I've heard the words climate change maybe once in this whole week. It feels like net 50, net zero has become this abstract thing, like completely divorced from any reality that we're living in. And it's just become this sort of like thing that we have to do, like flossing that no one really wants to do. And maybe we can just put it off and it doesn't relate to anything real.
No, exactly. It's terrible, terrible messaging. And the idea of tipping points, of runaway warming, is completely absent. When Bill Gates said the thing about, oh, society's not going to collapse. Well, society, according to some very eminent scientists, is going to collapse. But there was not a single voice, you know, actually making it through in the mainstream media. You go, this is rubbish. Of course we're at risk of societal collapse. We've spent years not being clear about the fact that these are catastrophic risks. And it's very sad to see it. Yeah, it's not. Well, it's Labor's responsibility as well. You know, the Chris Bowen line about we're going to be a renewable energy superpower. Well, great, but not a single mention of the risk of runaway warming. Not a single mention of food and water shortages, conflict, mass migration. What we're facing, possibly, you know, heading into just mid-century.
And do you have any events you'd like to promote?
There's a global day of action in the middle of the COP, and there is a Forests Are Our Future, it's called, protest in Melbourne from 12 till 3, starting at State Library.
Thank you for listening to the Climate Action Show today. It's a patchwork of ideas trying to focus on the new fund launched by Brazil called the Tropical Forest Forever Facility. You can look it up as TFFF. Thank you very much to Claudia Antunes, who is a journalist with Suma Uma, for giving us her time, to Jacinda Ardern and Christiana Figueres for permission to use their podcast, to Lisa Clegg for reading the story of the Yanomami women, and to Jane Morton and Antimony Dior for telling us in more detail about the biotic pump. We'll have more from COP later on, but this week, Democracy Now! Is covering COP from Belém every day. So if you tune into Democracy Now!, you will catch the latest from the, not so much from the official point of view, but from the point of view of the people from civil society who are there. As our first speaker, Claudia Torres, they're very proud of being a democracy now. It's not like one of those COPs where the public is cordoned off and civil society is locked out. They are proud to have all voices represented. My name is Vivian Langford. Good night and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.